Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. If you were a Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 edition player, or if you are a current Pathfinder player, then you know feats quite well. You're familiar with the concept. You may or may not be a fan of them. I happen to be a fan of them because I feel like they are nice, specialized, special bonuses that the players can take to feel that much more powerful. The interesting thing about mini feats is that they do increase a player's power, substantially sometimes, but very often only in specific situations. And so they have a way of breaking the game, as it were, but only under certain circumstances, which, to be fair, will only happen now and again. Even if a player specifically takes a feat that is particularly well-suited for the campaign or adventure that they're currently playing through, for instance, maybe a player takes a feat that provides them a special bonus against sea creatures because the campaign that they're playing in right now takes place on the water. Seems like a good investment, a wise choice. And you might think that that's gaming the system, but another way of looking at it is that the player has analyzed what kind of character they are playing, what the character's strengths are, why the character would have ventured out onto the open sea, and it makes a lot of sense for that character to have some kind of special trait that makes them particularly deadly against sea creatures or sea monsters. So, narratively, it makes a lot of sense, generally. Of course, there are times where there are exceptions, because on that seafaring campaign, out of the clear blue sky, possibly literally, there is a dragon who attacks the ship, and strangely, one of the characters suddenly, rather suddenly after leveling up, has a feat targeted directly at dragons. Maybe that's gaming the system a little bit. Maybe narratively it doesn't make much sense for this character who's been out to sea their entire life and probably have never actually encountered a dragon for them to have some kind of special talent where they can target the weakest point on a dragon seems a little bit convenient. But in my experience, and admittedly my experience is limited to the games that I've played in, or DM'd, but in my experience that doesn't really happen that often. And I'm not saying that it's impossible. I know that some players are quite unpleasant about sort of the ways that they maximize their characters, and some DMs are rather unpleasant about the things that they allow or don't allow in their campaigns, and sometimes it seems that it's conveniently simply to make a certain situation a little bit more difficult. Now, that speaks to the expectation in a Dungeons & Dragons campaign that encounters are expected to be difficult. They are expected to be a challenge. And so if your players have maximized their abilities, their feats, their special bonuses, against a very specific foe that they anticipated appearing, whether it's anticipating because of the way that the story is going, or whether it's just the natural kind of metagaming, as they say, that we all do. I mean, if the adventure's title is Dragons of the Open Sea, then it seems almost silly for a player to purposefully avoid feats that involve dragons on the pretense that, well, my character, my player character, is a pirate and has never encountered a dragon before. The name of the campaign is Dragons of the Open Sea, so it makes sense for you to design a character that's going to be good at seafaring activities as well as killing dragons. It's kind of natural, and frankly, it's part of the game. So, should that happen, then there's an expectation that the DM is clever enough to modify encounters and to play the monsters that the DM is playing in such a way that some of those feats that the players have chosen might be effective against one of the things being combated, but not everything, thereby making the combat or the encounter challenging despite the choices that the players have made. And that doesn't mean to nullify what the players are doing, it just means to add other stuff that the players may not have expected on top of the encounter as written. For instance, in my completely imaginary example, Dragons of the Open Sea, these seafarers might be out on the open sea, suddenly be attacked by a dragon. Maybe they've taken feats that give them bonuses against dragons in a way that really renders the encounter a lot less threatening. But what if a group of Sahuagin happened to be passing by at the very moment of the attack and decided to take advantage of the chaos and join in the attack? Now the players not only have to deal with the dragon that they do have bonuses against, but also the horde of lesser creatures on their ship's deck. So that's a very long preamble to what this episode's actually about, which is feats. And the more or less the lack of feats in 5th edition, which isn't true. There's actually feats available in 5th edition on page 165 of the Player's Handbook. It's an optional rule, and the way 5th edition handles it is that when you level up, if there is a boost on offer to an ability score, then instead of taking that ability score, you can instead choose a feat from the maybe 4 or 5 pages of available feats in the 5th edition Player's Handbook. This is arguably a pretty sane way to handle feats, honestly. It prevents characters, players, from overloading their characters with options that, well, frankly, you just don't remember from session to session. It might be written somewhere on your character sheet, but where is it again, and how do you remember that you have it in the first place in order to even take advantage of it? So, limiting feats to the couple of times you get an ability score increase, and then pairing the available feats down to, yeah, it's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pages front and back. It really limits what your players are going to throw at you from the Dungeon Master's perspective. There are things like a healer feat, a heavily armored feat, elemental adept, dungeon delver, mounted combatant, magic initiate, ritual caster, war caster, tavern brawler, sharpshooter, shield master. So you can kind of tell that these feats are not so much bonuses to specific situations necessarily, but almost they're a way to invoke archetypes. For instance, you're playing a fighter, but what you really have in mind is a fighter who can sometimes do a really cool force blast style attack, or a fiery, like a burning hands attack, or whatever. take Warcaster, and now suddenly you've essentially multiclassed without having to lose a level, you know, to sacrifice a level of your fighter for a level of initiate kind of spellcasting level. So it gives you, it broadens the spectrum for the players, which is really very cool. But compared to, for instance, Pathfinder, a list of feats, well, there's no contest, right? Pathfinder's feats take up, I don't know how many pages of the core rulebook. It's a lot. And there are feats for practically everything. Well, there's a third-party publisher called TPK Games, and they recently released, not so recently, I think it was in 2017 or so, but they released a book called 5th Edition Feats. And it is filled with about 150 feats written and designed for Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. Now, what it doesn't do is change the circumstance under which a player gains a feat. It has no... It doesn't offer any guidance on it within that regard. It's just, it's still within, you get, if your character is just leveled up and it happens to be a level where you get an attribute boost, then you sacrifice that and you take a feat. I have a slight problem with that idea, because a lot of the feats in this, I mean, 150 to choose from, a lot of these feel to me like they are not, like they are a lot more specific than the ones provided in the player's handbook. So the player's handbook, you can see how it would be advantageous to sacrifice that attribute score so that you can, for instance, do a fake multi-class, a free multi-class, essentially. I'm not so sure that it's worth doing that for very, very many of the feats provided in 5th edition feats, the book. So I'm not sure if I would use this in the same way that I use 5th edition feats in the first place. Not that I've ever actually had a player take a 5th edition feat in exchange for an attribute score, but I don't really play very long campaigns usually, so it could just be that that hasn't really come up. But if I was going to do that, I don't think that's the way that I would do this. I think I would make the feats a little bit more common, because these are a lot more specific. These are Pathfinder-style feats, while the 5th edition player's handbook has, I think, broadly defined feats. So for instance, I'm going to pull out some of the ones that I sort of like maybe the most out of here, just to give you a sample of what kind of feats we're talking about. For instance, here's one that I quite liked, Demon Slayer. You've been trained to fight creatures of the lower planes and survive. Prerequisite is wisdom 13 or above, and then arcana or religion proficiency. You gain a +1 to attacks made against demons or devils, and a +1 attack to your AC against their attacks. You may reroll a failed save against a devilish or demonic creature's special ability. You may only use this ability once per short rest. Your critical threat range against demons and devils increases by 1. So that's a pretty good feat. I would say that it was pretty specific. There's not exactly, I wouldn't say, something quite that specific that I can think of in the player's handbook. I could be maybe interpreting some of these a little bit more loosely than is fair. I mean, I think arguably things like Monster Combatant, that's actually pretty broad as well. Yeah, I think this is a lot more specific than any of the ones in Player's Handbook, so that's kind of what I mean by these being a little bit more Pathfinder-y. Now, there are a couple of ones that are pretty broad. looking right on the same page, actually, as Demon Slayer, there's Die Hard. You're especially hard to kill. Prerequisite, Endurance. You gain a +1 bonus to your Constitution score. You do not die immediately until you reach an amount of negative hit points equal to your con score plus your level. And you gain a +2 bonus on death saves. That's one of those that I think, in a way, this is kind of, it's almost a placebo. And letting a player choose this one would almost be weirdly sort of like wasting a slot, as it were. Because, I mean, Die Hard in games these days, how many people actually die anyway? I mean, depends on how you run your game, right? But I think a lot of the tendency these days is to keep players alive. So just to let someone actually spend whatever whatever rule you're using to when you give out feats, that kind of yes, it's a broad feat, but it's also a little bit useless, to be honest. But I mean, you know, if that's what the player wants, then that's what the player can have. Another one I liked was Elemental Spell. You can manipulate the elemental nature of your spells. Prerequisite is ability to cast first-level spells, so it's pretty low bar to entry. Choose one energy type, acid, cold, electricity, or fire. You may replace a spell's normal damage with that energy type, or split the spell's damage so that half of it is that energy and half of it is normal. An elemental spell uses up a spell slot one level higher than the spell's actual spell. I think that's a really beautifully designed feat. It's, I guess, a little bit meta-magic-y, and it's something that players can take at any point. It gives them a clear bonus because they can choose an energy type. Now, it doesn't say in the text, unfortunately, whether you're meant to choose one energy type when you take this feat, and that's the energy type that you have access to forever, or whether you choose one energy type when you are casting the spell. And so technically you have the energy type of all of them. I think I'd really have to think about which rule I would impose depending on the campaign. I imagine a lot of times just letting someone choose one type when they take the feat is probably sufficient. Letting them do that dynamically seems a little bit overpowered, but I guess it would probably depend. But the beauty of this one is that they can, the player gets that option to specifically deal some kind of damage to something if they know that that's what they need to do, but they're doing so at the cost of one level slot higher. So it's not just a free bonus. It is something that they can opt into because they feel like it's something that they need to do. It's that important. I really like that one. There are some that are specific to class. For instance, Healing Chakra. You can use Ki to heal yourself and others. Ki, if you don't know, is it's the currency, the spiritual currency of monks. So a monk has some number of ki points, or a pool of ki, that's ki, and can spend them for different class features. So the prerequisite for Healing Chakra is a wisdom score of 15 or above, and obviously the ability to use ki, so a ki class feature, which, like I say, is a monk thing, so either a monk or someone multi-classing into monk could use this. As an action, you can spend a key point to automatically stabilize another creature. They become conscious with a number of hit points equal to your wisdom modifier. If you fail a death save, you can expend a point of key to reroll that save. And as an action, you can expend a point of ki to heal another creature. They regain 1d6 points plus your wisdom modifier. So I thought that was a kind of a clever way to tap into very specific class skills. It sort of remixes or maybe redefines some of the feats otherwise available in the player's handbook. For instance, there is a shield mastery feat. Your skill with shields is nearly unmatched. Prerequisite, shield expertise. When you wield a shield of any kind, your AC improves by +1. You may add your strength modifier to offhand attacks made with shields. The 5th edition player's handbook has something a little bit similar to that called shield master, and in this one this is what the player's handbook says. You use shields not just for protection but for offense. You gain the following benefits while you are wielding a shield. If you take the attack action on your turn, you can use a bonus action to try to shove a creature within 5 feet of you with your shield. If you aren't incapacitated, you can add your shield's AC bonus to any dexterity saving throw you make against a spell or other harmful effect. If you are subjected to an effect that allows you to make a dexterity saving throw to take only half damage, you can use your reaction to take no damage if you succeed on the saving throw, interposing your shield between yourself and the source of the effect. So that's the shield master feat, and this book provides a shield mastery feat. So not exactly a remix, but in the same vein, and with some different benefits, and a different feel, really. Shield Master is kind of all about taking your dexterity and bolstering it, because you happen to have this big wall between you and the thing that you are dex saving against, or moving against. Whereas Shield Mastery is a little bit more about just the mechanics of what a shield does. It improves your AC by 1, and you can add your strength modifier to offhand attacks made with your shield. So it's more about the shield than the way that you use it, I guess. There are a couple of feats like that. There's like a stealthy feat, a steel-minded feat, things that kind of take existing mechanics, toughness, that's a good one, take existing mechanics and give them small bonuses to, I guess, more or less to make them feel a little bit more like you're even better at them than you thought you were. So, for instance, let's go ahead and read the stealthy, actually. You're skilled at stealth. Prerequisite, dex 13 or above, and stealth proficiency. You can make hide checks when you are only lightly obscured. If you are hidden and make a ranged attack, you remain hidden. You can see in dim light without penalty. That sort of thing. So it really takes the ideas of probably what you think your class should already be doing, and it gets you a little bit closer to that. I think these are a lot of fun. There's 150 of them. Obviously not going to go through all of them, but the book is a lot of fun to read through. It gives you lots and lots of ideas, and frankly, all of the feats in here, maybe with one or two exceptions, not that I can think of off the top of my head, I'm just allowing for them, all of the feats in here, I think would make combat a lot more fun. And that's what feats very often tend to do. Now, it also makes combat a lot more complex, and I realize that, and I think that's probably why 5th edition moved them away from, you know, moved them really into an optional rule, because it makes combat more complex. It possibly slows things down, because you have to sort of recalculate everything based on, oh, by the way, I have this feat, and under the circumstances, it would be under effect, so what does that mean for, you know, what actually happened in this scenario? And that sort of question, when you have to stop and recalculate everything, that does tend to make combat, you know, it can turn a 20-minute combat into an hour-long combat really, really easily. Nobody likes that. But if you're used to using feats, and if you can roll with feats, and you have a good handle on combat, you're comfortable as a DM running combat, and you know how to feel out when a combat is, well, it's whether it's boring or whether it's too easy or whether it's about to kill your party, you know how to adjust one way or the other. Then adding feats, giving those to the players, I think it makes the combat a lot more fun because there are a lot more exceptions that happen. Things that the bad guys do seem less dire because the player has something in their back pocket that everyone else forgot about and is able to pull it out at that very moment and tell you why, no, actually, that didn't crit, or that didn't even hit. And vice versa. The players have these little tricks up their sleeve where they're fighting a bad guy and they do something really, really cool, and everyone at the table cheers because everyone had forgotten about that feat. But hey, this is a demon after all, so you do get that plus one, and you do have that crit plus one. And now the demon is dead. Again, obviously, as a DM, you have to anticipate that that can now happen, because you've got all these new rule-breaking effects in play. But if you're okay with that, if you're comfortable with that, then I think adding feats into 5th edition is a great, great idea. I think it's a lot of fun for the players. It's one of those ways to break rules without lessening the rarity of, for instance, magic items, right? That's the other way to have this effect, is to throw magic items at the players. Give them special items that have special effects against certain kinds of creatures, and then they pull those things out when that kind of creature comes along, and the combat goes very differently than it might have gone otherwise. But the fear that it seems a lot of modern RPGers have is that if you throw a bunch of magic items into your world, then they're no longer magic. It's just basically, that's the way most swords work in this world, and what idiot goes out adventuring without a plus one sword? Whereas feats, I feel like that makes the player special, the individual player special, because the other three players, or however many players you've got, the other three players around at the table don't have that. They don't have bonuses against a demon, or they can't make an attack and remain hidden, because they don't have that stealth feat. There might be another rogue in the party, but he can't do that. She can. So it becomes this sort of the exception. It retains the exceptionality of the player, because they're the ones who took that feat and no one else did. And when you have 150 feats to choose from, the likelihood of each player having a different specialty is pretty high. So I'm a fan of feats, is what I'm trying to say. I think that Total Party Kill Games has done us a wonderful service by coming out with 5th edition feats, and I highly suggest that you check it out. And in terms of storytelling, I think that feats is a great read, even if you're not playing actively in a game. I think reading over these things and getting a glimpse of what kind of characters these feats describe is absolutely inspiring. I think a lot of times we get caught up as storytellers, whether we're writing stories or planning little movies or planning a game, we get caught up a lot of times in the obvious shorthand of archetypes. We have the thief character, or we have the romantic, or we have the hero, or the knight in shining armor, or whatever we've got. They're there and they're obvious, and the things at the surface are the ones that are already built into that story. It's almost like we're retelling a story and we forgot to remix it because it's the same hero as every other hero. Looking at feats, at 150 different feats, you get this picture of 150 different people, really. You get an idea of what kind of person might specialize in stealth, or in being a combat caster, or casting elemental spells or being able to improvise a weapon from whatever they pick up. Inspiring leadership, rapid shot, razor tooth, ritualist, shield of swings, skill focus, strike back, thespian, thundering spell, toppling spell. All these different ideas, you read them and you get you no longer are concentrating on archetypes. You are concentrating on the exceptions that make this particular person, that yes, their base premise might be an archetype that everyone's seen before, but this one unique trait that they have, this thing that they do extremely well for whatever weird reason, that's what makes them unique. And then develop the story of why they do have that specialty. How did they get that specialty, that feat? What's the backstory of that? How did they develop that? It's a great, great exercise for writing and for coming up with characters who are truly unique and different and sort of your own, rather than retelling a story with the same five character types. That's really all I have for this episode, but before I sign off, I would like to point you towards an interesting 5th edition and Pathfinder related project that I recently undertook. It has been posted to mixedsignals.ml. If you go there and look at the April, I think it must have been April 9th or so, posting, April 5th, sorry, I'm ahead of myself, April 5th posting, you'll find that there is a Pathfinder 5th edition character sheet. What is a Pathfinder 5th edition character sheet? That doesn't exist. Well, no, it doesn't. And what I did was I have been playing in a couple of different games, and with one specific group that I play with, usually about once a month, we kind of switch back and forth between Pathfinder and 5th edition. And after a while, we kind of started to notice that the character sheets, when you're looking at your character sheet, your eyes kind of know where to go, typically. And when you're swapping back and forth between character sheets, you don't develop that muscle memory, or you develop a muscle memory for one and not the other. So you can't remember where to look to find something relatively important, like your armor class, or your base attack bonus, or your speed, whatever it might be. And it started to get kind of annoying that we would forget where to look half the time for information that's really pretty important. And so I was kind of sitting down and looking at the 5th edition character sheet, because everyone pretty much universally in the group preferred that. That was the character sheet that we kept sort of going back to and sort of wondering, sometimes aloud, sometimes privately, why isn't the Pathfinder sheet more like that? And it's one of those things that you don't really notice until you see one and then the other, and you have to use them sort of in, you know, just right after one another. And you realize, well, there's just so much information on one, and the other one is it really kind of abstracts a lot of that information away. Now, that could be a bad thing, because you don't really understand, for instance, when you're making a specific check against one of your skills, maybe it's kind of difficult to remember what you're supposed to add into that skill in order to come up with the final bonus number. But I feel like most of us in this group are familiar enough with that that's not actually a problem. So having different columns for every single kind of bonus that you need to add to your roll in order to get your final correct value, that wasn't something that we were too concerned about. That wasn't something that was troubling us. Mainly it was solely a question of, well, where do my eyes need to go in order to get that number quickly? So Well, I took a stab once at sort of simplifying the Pathfinder character sheet in a LibreOffice spreadsheet. And LibreOffice, if you don't know that one, is a free office suite for Linux, Mac, and Windows. It runs on all three of them. You can download the character sheet from a project. I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes. But really, it kind of assumes that you're on a computer because it is a spreadsheet. So you kind of, the expectation is that you're doing it on a computer. And I originally did that because in a separate game I was doing, it was over the computer. So it was a natural thing to do. But like I say, the actual problem wasn't so much as about the number of blanks on the sheet as the layout was. And so I thought, well, maybe I could restructure the Pathfinder character sheet. And so then I thought, well, instead of just restructuring it, why don't I just rip off the Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition one? Wouldn't that be a better idea? And so I took the Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition character sheet, took it into a program called Inkscape, and translated it from PDF to just the vector outlines, the lines and things like that that they drew in order to make the character sheet. And I started modifying it. And I came up with a pretty good combination of the two. The skills are now on the left. The Pathfinder skills are now on the left side of the sheet, which is where they are on the 5th edition version. Now, there are a lot more skills in Pathfinder than 5th edition, so that meant that other elements had to move around. So there's some inconsistency, but generally speaking, all the information is now roughly in the same place on both 5th edition and Pathfinder. And the gaming group that I did this for has really, really enjoyed it. They've appreciated the reduction of visual information and the combination or the standardization of where that information is located, and just kind of the aesthetic of it. Just now you can pull out either your Dungeons & Dragons character or your Pathfinder character, and they look basically the same. Some of the information's a little bit different, but the essence of the sheet itself is essentially the same. So I've posted the sheet. It's a PDF download. It's technically 3 pages, because technically the Dungeons & Dragons character sheet is 3 pages. I don't think many people actually use all 3 pages. I think a lot of people just use the first page, honestly. The second page is technically a character background sheet, where you're supposed to describe your character and talk about what organizations they're a member of and so on. I didn't think that deserved it to be a second page, because when you're printing these things, usually it's front and back. So really, I figured more often than not, the back is going to be your spell sheet. So the second page on mine is the spell sheet, which is exactly just lifted straight out of the Dungeons & Dragons one, really. I changed some of the fonts so that it would mimic the first page that I did, but that's about it. And then the third page is a character sheet, in case someone wants to write down a whole bunch of stuff about their character. But in my experience, people generally just sort of have that in their head. They don't tend to write it down. But you can download it for free. It's a PDF. It's on mixedsignals.ml. It's April 5th post. Or you can just do a search for Pathfinder 5e character sheet, whatever, and you'll find it. So check that out if that sounds something that would be useful for your gaming group, or if it just sounds interesting to look at. By all means, take a look. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.